Okay, we're here with Professor Fraser, Andrew Fraser. I guess what we should do is we should start by talking a bit about why it is that Majority Rights is interviewing you. There was an event that occurred fairly recently where you were suspended from your professorship and then you subsequently resigned. Yeah. Could you talk a little bit about that event?
Well, I had, before that whole controversy arose, I had already decided to retire from the university. So this was, had nothing to do with me leaving. It's just that, I made some comments about African immigration in particular and immigration generally in a local paper. It became a kind of a media cause celeb, and the very politically correct vice chancellor of the university totally freaked. That's really the story in a nutshell.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So the fact that your retirement was coming up, did that give you a sense of, I guess, a bit more freedom to say what was on your mind? Or, I mean, when you said they're not connected at all, was
Oh,
was
it's the not case connected at all. I mean, I was, at daggers drawn with the vice chancellor on issues, and indeed most of my colleagues on these issues for years now. So that was neither here nor there.
Okay. Mm-hmm. I just wanted to make sure that we covered that a bit, yeah, because of the fact that there's a great deal of, like you said, there was a cause celeb, yeah, in the media, yeah, and a lot of people heard, yeah, about that. Could you tell us a little bit about your background, your family background? You're Fraser, yeah, and I'm also a Fraser in my genealogy.
Yeah.
So we share some background in that respect. I suppose that's good ethics to notify people of our nepotism,
yeah,
here right away. But anyway, what's your ethnic background and your family
background? Well, on my father's side, the Fraser family came over from Inverness County to Glengarry County in Canada in around 1806. As happened often in the British Dominions, they got intermingled with the Anglo-Saxons and Irish who were there, and in effect became more British than the British, in the sense that those kind of ethnic boundaries in the UK itself broke down in Canada and Australia and New Zealand. So I guess I'd say I'm sort of British generically, you know.
Right. Yeah, a lot of people have claimed, for example, that New Zealand is more British than the British. And I suppose there are a lot of ways in which the people who migrated to some of the colonies preserved some dimensions of the culture that may have been, for various reasons, lost or otherwise altered in the homeland. Mm-hmm. Is that the kind of thing that you've run across in your studies of history, or is that sort of just...
That sense of Britishness is faded almost to the point of invisibility out here in Australia, and certainly it's true back in Canada and New Zealand as well. So I'd have to say, I mean, and that's of course the thing about being British. I mean, it was a kind of a step away from ethnic nationalism in the beginning. The whole idea of the UK was the creation of a state that transcended ethnicity. And so British patriotism was the one of the first sorts of constitutional patriotism that emerges in the modern world.
Okay, so would you say that your family background is tied up in that, those events?
Well, yeah, I mean, you can't escape. I mean, indeed, just being Canadian or Australian, you can't escape that sort of problem. We've really lost touch with who we are.
I see. So in your personal development, what would you say the most important influences have been?
I guess In childhood, I mean, my father was killed in a car accident when I was about 10. I then wound up living in a small town up in northern Ontario. That was a very important, very homogeneous little town with one black guy who was a teacher in the school and a Baptist minister and quite a good friend of mine actually, but he was my sole experience of racial diversity growing up. So I grew up in a very ethnically homogeneous sort of area. Then went to Queen's University in Kingston, Ontario, another, old Scottish Canadian sort of university, which at the time was again almost pure white. Very, very different now, of course. But I don't come from an urban background, sort of rural, semi-rural, ethnically homogeneous. And so for me, the whole multiracial transformation of Canada and Australia has been kind of a shock that took me a while to wake up to, though.
Yeah, so I guess we share that. I would imagine a lot of people share that background where they grew up in an environment very different from the one that they now experience, and they would prefer not to have to raise their children in an environment that's that much different, let alone live their the remaining years. So what would you consider to be your most important accomplishment or accomplishments in your career?
Well, in my career, I mean, like in my life, I guess I'm glad I got married, remained married long enough to raise a couple of kids and so on. Apart from that, just I the things I've written, the kinds of stuff I taught as a law teacher and so on. I mean, that was all very satisfying to me.
Well, I guess that brings us to your current work, which is a book. Could you tell us a bit about the book and its genesis?
Well, I suppose going back, broadly speaking, what's interested me through most of my career has been the history of classical republicanism as a kind of a constitutional tradition and so on. Only recently have I it did the penny drop for me that this tradition really is uniquely Western, and that it has been con it is now suffering a precipitous decline precisely because of the third world colonization of the West. Anyway, so but this doesn't seem to be a problem for our elites. And my whole experience over the past couple of years really makes me want to try to work out just why our elites are so ready to betray us. So the book I'm writing is entitled Anglo-Saxon Anglophobia, and I'm trying to figure out what it is about the Anglo-Saxon people that l makes them so open to this what this form of cultural and national suicide.
So you've got a diagnosis, at least to start on a diagnosis and perhaps prescription for this situation, I take it.
Well, I think it goes right back to the beginning. I mean, the basic problem it is, I mean, just diagnosing the problem. It is at the elite level, at the kind of intellectual and political level, it's this idea of the proposition nation, constitutional patriotism, and so on, and the absolute horror that one must feel towards any form of ethnic solidarity among Anglo-Saxons. In particular, I mean, ethnic solidarity is perfectly all right for other folks, but not for us, because we're sort of above that, and we have The Anglo-Saxon burden is to spread that message that there is no such thing as race and so on to the lesser breeds, I guess. You know, and
well, that's kind of a funny way of putting it because it's self-contradictory,
yeah,
right?
Sure.
Lesser breeds.
That's right.
I mean, if so there's a sense in the Anglo-Saxon elite that they are superior,
yeah,
but at the same time they're trying to say that everybody's the,
yeah,
same. Is,
yeah,
that, is that sort of the strange irony?
Oh yeah,
or
I mean it is
hypocrisy?
Very much bound up with moral vanity. You know, I mean, it's a way of demonstrating, displaying one's contempt for one's own fellow Anglo-Saxons is a way of demonstrating one's moral superiority. You know? So, and the question is, how does this all begin? And it seems to me that if you want to answer that question, really, you have to go right back to the Anglo-Saxon invasions of the British Isles.
Well, yeah, I think what we can do is we can discuss that within the context of the prescription. In other words, the structure of the problem in our history informs the prescription, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay,
yeah.
So let's start with that. Let's say what is the prescription for getting ourselves out of this mess, and let's talk about the way that relates to our history and why it therefore would be effective.
Well. How we're going to get out of this? I mean, my sinking feeling is that we're going to have to really things are going to have to get a lot worse before they get better, and that we're really going to have to experience the full range of catastrophes coming down the pike towards us before we are driven to recognize reality in effect. And so I.
So you would you say this is the elite needs to recognize?
Well, I think we all do,
or?
Because I mean the elites couldn't get away with the sort of blatant treason they're perpetrating if the rest of us weren't prepared to acquiesce in it. So, and I mean, in a nutshell, I mean, I think what has to happen is that we, in effect, go back to the future, you know, that we recover some of the old traditions that made us strong, and reincorporate those sorts of institutions and practices into our lives and get away from, get out of this bubble we've been living in for the past couple of hundred years, this Enlightenment bubble, the you know, that's based upon the premise that eternal progress is possible, that we're living in this cornucopian economy. And so, I mean, so, and things like, I mean, well, I mean, where do you start? Universal suffrage, I mean, is one of the great symptoms of our decline. So, and I think, I can't see how we're going to pull ourselves out of the situation before that particular practice disappears.
So what was it that made that practice appear?
Well, once again, I mean, I think it's the, it, you know, this is where you have to go back to figure out who we are and why we got this way. But I mean, I think one of the characteristic things about the development of the Anglo-Saxon character is that we have been a very trusting sort of people. We are a high trust society, if you like, as compared to other low trust societies, like the higher end China, lower end Africa, let's say. And for that reason, when, you know, that's why things like the law of contract became possible in England, right? People were prepared to engage in interactions with strangers and so on. And so, it gets bound up with Enlightenment, the Enlightenment and evangelical Christianity, and we then believe that women are just like men and all men are equal, and you know, we just we're so willing to trust each other's trust each other that we've just lost sight of certain basic realities.
So you'd say a degree of, if not suspicion, then skepticism needs to be inculcated to counteract sort of our predisposition to
Well,
trust. Is that what
yeah,
you're saying?
well, let's put it this way. That trusting disposition worked well when Anglo-Saxons were living on their own or in settler societies where the indigenous population was neither very large nor very powerful. And when in effect men did still feel capable of justified in exercising their particular role in society. I mean, but once all of those sorts of condition and we start living in a multiracial society, the disposition to trust the other becomes extremely maladaptive, I think.
So, in the situation that created universal suffrage, for example, is this predisposition toward trust, which arose in an environment where the selective pressures just were not there to make people very suspicious or skeptical of each other. Obviously, there were other selective pressures that were shaping our character as well. What are some of those selective
Well,
pressures,
I
and what are their
mean, I think
characteristics?
the really fundamental shift, in the development of our people was what well, came in the early modern period with all of those things, urbanization, capitalist modernization, and so on. Real, I mean, and for me, I mean, I think of it in terms of the development of the common law tradition and so on. And the most striking manifestation of that is the way in which instead the common law tradition up until, let's say, the 17th century, tended to look backwards. Okay, I mean, what was something was right and proper and authoritative because it was old, and it was, it kind of developed over generations and so on and so forth. After that, the whole orientation of the modern world has become focused on the future, manifested most obviously in the whole utilitarian ethic and so on, right? So the once you start thinking in those terms, a whole lot of things follow. You start thinking of society as a complex system that really requires management from on high, rather than as a collection of autonomous, self-governing households, communities, states, or whatever. So, and that's, I mean, the idea of a free, almost stateless society was the strength of Anglo-Saxon civilization. Once we move beyond that, into this kind of utopian quest for the perfect society, things really began to become, well, corrupt, I suppose, is the only way to put it.
So the centralization of this managerial elite, as opposed to, I guess what I've seen in the outline of your book and some of the comments, or the text of some of it, is the aristocracy, which I understand you would like to reestablish in some way, is what? What is the difference between a managerial elite and an aristocracy?
Well, the managerial elite that we have now is essentially, I mean, in the you've got, a managerial elite in the corporate sector, and then you've got another sort of competing managerial elite in the public sector and so on. And the key to the development of that class is the rise of the modern business corporation. Okay, and so the modern business corporation, as Marx recognized, really meant the abolition of private property. You know what I mean? The separation of ownership and control in the corporate sector has created this sort of gap between those who notionally own the corporations, i.e. the shareholders, and those who are in actual control of the corporate sector. And those who are in actual control of the corporate sector are kind of structurally cut off from both their ancestors and their posterity in a way that was not true, certainly of a landed aristocracy, or even of your standard issue capitalist. I mean, in other words, if you're the CEO of a major corporation, you can't just hand your position on to your son or your daughter in today's world. Right. I mean, they have to go to Harvard Business School and some, and you may have connections and so on that can smooth their path. But and because that's true, there's a way in which family, even at that micro level, has become obviously much less important in the lives of our elites than it used to be. Yeah.
So you're saying, I mean, what some people would say is that you're actually recommending incorporation or integration of nepotism into the social fabric in a way that's legitimate or recognized as being
normative. Sure. I mean, I think there is definitely a place for a class of people who are in a position to hand on that position to their descendants and so on.
The Anglo-Saxon tradition starts with the family, almost a nuclear family, with a head of household that in some sense is the public face of the family. And that public face corresponds to what you would say is the suffrage. In other words, the head of the household has suffrage, but not the rest of the household. And in so doing, one makes the continuity of the generations more a part of the fabric of society at all levels, including the aristocracy. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, I mean, when you have a situation where the head of the household is the public face of that household or family, presumably that individual, that man historically, had to consider the interests of his family. Because presumably other members of the family, being aware of his position, were in a position to say, hey, don't forget us. You know, but the way it is now, each member of a family, vote, once you're 18, your children, even if they're living at home, get to vote. And they don't have, your wife gets to vote. She doesn't, she can consider her own interests, your children consider, and in fact, indeed, the whole structure of this thing, it's secret. So they can have the most selfish, cavalier, idiotic reasons for casting ballots the way they do. No one knows what they've done. And there's no accountability or responsibility.
So what you're saying is that within the family there would be some accountability on the part of the head of household to represent the interests of the entire family, and that would be expressed in the head of household's vote. Ideally, or I guess what you're saying is historically that was the case, and that's the back to the future solution that you're recommending. And with regard to that public face and how they go about representing their family, let's say that you've got children, you've got two families. One family has children, the other one doesn't. How does that change the voting power or the representation power of that head of household?
Well, it seems to me if you were going to try to think about this in terms of the classical Republican tradition, You would really want to recognize that if a household with, let's say, a husband, wife, and two, three, four children should have a number of votes corresponding to the number of souls contained within that household. And conversely, if you're just a bachelor living on your own, you should get one vote and one vote only, but the head of a household who is representing, say, four or five other people ought to get five or six votes.
So, in a sense, that this is, how can I say this? You're actually giving children a voice in a way that they don't normally have a voice, say, in today's society. They're supposedly given a voice by virtue of the fact that there are managerial elites that are looking out for the interests of children, despite their parents. But what you're saying is that in this situation, in this Anglo-Saxon tradition, the parents would be given accorded a certain amount of respect because they had children in their public dealings, and so their votes would carry a bit more weight because of the fact that they had children.
That's right. And of
Okay.
course, it to me, I mean, like it would also be important in that kind of context that the other at least adult members of the family or household recognize the house, sort of formally recognize the head of the household's right to represent them. And if you couldn't get that formal, if let's say if you're living with a spouse who won't agree with you that either she or you ought to vote, then basically neither one of you gets to vote. You
Okay, so
got
a
there's
house
got to
divided basically
loses
loses
out.
its franchise. Yeah, the franchise is lost by a house divided. That's an interesting effect. So what's the difference between this? I mean, well, I guess we see one difference right away, but if you think about things from the standpoint of the corporation that you brought up earlier, it's an interesting institution in the sense that you have proxy votes where you can have a number of people who will cast their proxy to somebody who will be a proxy holder. What is the difference between a proxy holder and a head of household?
Well, it one of the interesting things about the corporation, the business corporation, is that something that not many people realize that I suppose a lot of people realize that the modern business corporation really emerges in America. But what they don't know is that back in early 19th century New England, where these corporations emerged, they emerged essentially for to serve a political rather than an economic purpose, and they were conceived essentially as little republics, so that each shareholder got one vote, no matter how many shares he had. It was voting by voice rather than by shares, if you get my drift. And often, courts would reject the idea of proxy voting in principle, just by saying that, look, if you're not interested enough in the affairs of the company to come along to a meeting and listen to the discussion and debate the issues, then you don't deserve to vote.
So one of the things that makes the proxy system inferior to, I guess, what you're, in some sense what you're saying is one soul, one vote through familial connections as opposed to deracinated proxies, is that there's less of an opportunity to so centralize power that the people whose franchise are being is being exercised are, in a sense, out of the loop.
This is especially becomes especially a problem when you shift away from the one voice, one vote rule to the one share, one vote rule. That is really the foundation of managerial control in the corporation.
Well, one share, one vote tends to place greater value on personal wealth than personal existence.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah,
So that so
exactly.
one of the things in the Anglo-Saxon tradition is this tendency to sort of balance out the idea that personal wealth is not the be-all and end-all, and personal existence has a greater role, not just in what we would think of in today as democracy, but in the corporate sphere as well.
Yeah.
And the role of the Anglo-Saxon kind of, should I say, humanized corporation is different from the monetized corporation in precisely the sense that the humanized corporation of the Anglo-Saxon tradition would tend to function more in a broader range of roles in society and be more responsive to the people. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, and I mean, it seems to me, once again, thinking about the corporation, the reform of the corporation from a Republican point of view, the kind of argument I've been trying to make is that the corporation is really the sphere, a sphere in which it really is appropriate to think about reintroducing the principle of political equality and B, a property qualification for the franchise. So it seems to me that what we really need are a class, I mean, this is what I would say, a new aristocracy, a new kind of shareholder senate, where every member of that shareholder aristocracy in a given corporation has one vote and one vote only, but you're only entitled to vote if you have a substantial threshold stake in the corporation. You know, so that you've got people who have a real interest in the fate of that business, but who you know can't be. It's not going to be a situation where simply only money talks.
Right.
If you get
and,
my drift.
Moreover, the number of shareholders is going to be limited.
Yeah.
Simply because of the fact that they're actually going to have to be interacting
yes.
in an effective sense.
Yes.
There's an inherent decentralization. But there's also an inherent aristocracy that's the touchstone for which is one's ability to buy in to the threshold of being a voice in one of these humanized corporate forms.
Yeah, and it would be essentially a self-selecting aristocracy because, like, presumably there would be people who have the wherewithal to get, you know, reach that threshold stake, but who can't be bothered. And in which case they don't make an effort. Whereas the only people who would be involved presumably are people who want to be involved, who have some sort of, what could you say, public spirit.
Franchise then does to some extent depend upon personal wealth because of the fact that you're going to have that threshold to buy in.
Yeah.
Now, a great many people will not have that level of personal wealth.
Yeah.
Presumably, there would be various ways that they could acquire it. One of the things that seems to be very important in the Anglo-Saxon tradition is, there are a couple of things that are kind of related. One of them is the allodium, or the allodia law, where one's land ownership is in some sense inalienable and is in some sense also tied to their ability to act as an effective defender of their territory. And this gets back to a state of nature where people and other animals have the ability, and generally males will have the ability to control a certain amount of territory.
Yep.
And that allodium, or that ability to defend your own territory, also plays into their ability to contribute to the defense of the realm. Now, the commoners did, in particular the yeoman farmers, played an important role in this in Anglo-Saxon history. How does one balance the interests of the what I would have to call the yeoman farmers against the aristocracy in the Anglo-Saxon tradition?
In the context of the corporation, you mean?
I guess what I'm saying is that there's a tendency for wealth to centralize simply by virtue of the fact that property rights are protected. In other words, if you can go about your business and there can be a certain amount of economic growth taking place just by virtue of the fact that you own, say, a piece of land, that land becomes more valuable.
Yeah. And, oh, sure.
And this gets back into some ideas I sort of wanted to cover with you related to John Stuart Mill, Henry George, and even into the modern era where people talk about land value, rents being things that can be taxed to raise revenue that are not distorting. And going back to Machiavelli, if you look at some of his comments, say, in fact, in introducing the discourses, he talked about the fact that if you want to keep people's character strong in choosing a location for a city, it's important for a ruler to make it so that the environment is not too benign to try to keep people's character strong. And if there's this kind of economic rent, this sort of unearned increment in value that accrues to them simply by virtue of the fact that they have ownership, then this can corrupt the aristocracy.
Sure. I mean, it seems to me a lot of let's put it this way. It seems to me that we're going to probably, who knows when, but sooner or later, given the kinds of things like, you know, peak oil and various other forms of imminent catastrophe, it does seem that the kind of modern megapolis is not really going to be sustainable in the long run. And large-scale corporate agriculture probably isn't going to be sustainable in the long run. So there may actually, it may not be that far off a time when one can imagine a kind of a significant return to the land for significant numbers of people. In other words, that, you know, centuries-long process of depopulating the countryside and people congregating in the cities really may be reversed to a significant extent, in which case then if you do get the return of things like the family farm and so on, once again, I mean, you are going to have a kind of a class of people emerging who will inevitably be able to counterbalance to some degree the sort of plutocrats in the city, one would hope. I mean, that kind of balance has really got completely eliminated in our lives over the past century and a half. And that's,
so how do you see this correction, I guess I'd have to say, of population distribution and population density taking place, given the fact that right now you have enormous centralizations of land ownership?
Well, you also have, it does seem to me, I mean, just sort of an unsustainable situation with especially the United States, even more so than Australia, being built around automobile. The car, right? I mean, the whole society is built around the availability of cheap oil. That is going to end. And even, as I say, large-scale corporate agriculture depends on oil, not just to run all the machines, but for fertilizers and so on. I would bet that before long, a major crisis is going to emerge in Western societies that are built around suburbs and automobiles and so on. It can't go on. So there's.
This gets into something that I'm going to sort of use myself as an example because it's easy for me to do. I was basically in computer programming for about 35 years, and because of immigration, I've had my profession destroyed.
Oh, right, okay.
So I went out to a small town in the Pacific Northwest, pretty much rural, and started running a place, doing just odd jobs here and there, trying to survive. And started a garden and met somebody and got married, and we're both interested in doing subsistence kind of farm work. So we basically are on the track to being yeoman farmers,
Oh,
which
really?
my family background is. And there were a variety of things that happened back in Iowa that deprived our family of our
Yeah.
land. But in the present circumstance, land values have gone up to the point, and my ability to acquire money has gone down
Oh,
to the point
Yeah.
where I can only rent small pieces of property, and I can't get enough land to really do much of anything that wouldn't require just so much money
Yeah.
that I'm in no position to do that. So what I can do is I can go and run a garden, but if I try to do any capital investments, it has to be on somebody else's land, and it really discourages me from making any kind of investment. So I'm t
Yeah.
talking to you from a, just a, you know, a raw reality of what's really happening right now to real people perspective. This is ground truth, mister. I'm out there and I'm facing the fact that, you know, the land use policies require that you buy a certain amount of land in large chunks. You have a certain amount of land that you can buy, a certain amount of money, while your profession is being destroyed,
Yeah.
and you're trying to escape from the urban areas. And I guess what I'm saying is that, you know, my experience of this, if it's at all, you know, indicative of what's going on, and I think that it is, looking around at what's happening to other people. Is they're being shoved out of the cities with no land, and they can't make an investment in the land to become yeoman farmers
Oh, sure,
because of
because
the
you've
fact
got
that it's owned by other people.
yeah, and also because you presumably small farms have to compete against big corporate agribusiness in
Well, no, I'm
the
talking about it just from the standpoint of subsistence. In other
yeah.
words, looking at the fact that if I wanted to go on welfare, I'd have to go into a bureaucracy that is
Yeah.
hostile to me because I'm a heterosexual white male.
Yeah.
You know, it's something that is very unappealing, and so being able to just simply raise my own food is very important. Being able to get a small structure that I can live in, that I can maintain,
Yeah.
is very important. None of this is achievable without being able to get land,
Oh, sure,
and at least a small amount of.
but can you see that? I mean, if we're talking about right now, I mean, I can s imagine that must be the case because you're presumably the in the market for land. I mean, you anyone looking for a little plot of land to, you know, sort of live on and grow on, has to compete with housing developments and you know, a whole lot of other sort of land uses, all of which are built around this so it's kind of corporate system that is premised on the availability of cheap oil. You know what I mean? So, I mean, in the long run, I mean, that situation isn't tenable. I mean,
Right. So, I guess what I'm trying to get at is, I'm sort of using my personal situation as a springboard to talk about that. I'm saying, okay,
Yeah.
now, as we get to peak oil or whatever it is that's going to precipitate the exodus from the cities
Yeah.
in a larger number than these few individuals like myself,
Yeah.
what kind of transformations or situations are they going to face that can that we can learn from history? Our ways of dealing with the situation of very centralized land ownership.
Well, I guess. I mean, it depends what sort of catastrophe scenario you want to sort of dream up. But like, if the argument that, or if the basic premise that this system is heading for some sort of collapse, then you know, in a sense, all the assumptions that are built into the ruling class way of life now are going to start to unravel. I mean, you know, the first thing about that's so, the first most striking thing about the managerial elite is that for the first time in history, it is a ruling class that denies the very existence of a ruling class. Okay, I mean, and it really is a kind of an irresponsible ruling class because it's always got whatever goes wrong It's always got the built-in excuse that it's the system, not us. You know, or it was the last guy who was CEO, it's not me, or whatever. And in any case, I'm moving on in 3 years' time. And the welfare state looks after the kind of dysfunctions and so on. If all of that starts to unravel, and just for example, the property, the wealthy classes, the plutocrats in our society, can no longer just have the state tax the middle class in order to look after the lumpen proletariat or whatever, you're going to have a lot of very seriously angry people. And in the United States, a lot of them are armed. You know, so the chances of very serious civil disorder and political instability emerging in our societies are very large. And I sooner or later, you're going to get to a point where the ruling class is going to actually have to take off the managerial mask and start taking responsibility for the way things are. You know, I mean,
okay,
and
at this point, maybe we should start talking about a tradition in the U.S. that has existed at least since the Civil War, which is posse comitatus, yeah, and its history in Anglo-Saxon social structure. There was, because what we're talking about is a situation where there could be a armed conflict over land, mm-hmm, over control of land or ownership or yeah, however the description you want to use is, and in that situation there could be application of the federal government's military against the population to enforce the land ownership of the managerial class. Do you see, mm-hmm, this as a possibility? Or okay?
Oh yeah, sure.
So, if that's the case, how does this play out against the Anglo-Saxon tradition and the Anglo-Saxon culture? Specifically, I'm thinking of the comitatus.
Well, once again, I mean, it's one of the things that we've sort of lost sight of is the need to sort of build these little local communities, that little self-sufficient, self-governing local communities. We have become dependent on big government and big corporations. And we have no sense to speak of ethnic or racial solidarity. So, in the the as disorder spreads, I think Anglo-Saxons are definitely going to go through a very dramatic process of natural selection. The weaker, more trusting, what could you say, liberal-minded sorts of people are really going to be put to the test. And I think sooner or later, I hope that our people do find ways of, once again, recovering their old strengths and their old capacity to bind themselves together simply by the power of oaths and so on, into an effective sort of social and political force. But I wouldn't hold out much hope for us in the short run, or even the medium term. I mean, we are a very weak, soft, muddle-headed people now. Corrupt, indeed. Corrupt is the old Republican word I'm searching for, and if there ever was an example of a people grown corrupt, it would have to be Anglo-Saxons in America, Britain, Canada, Australia, and New Zealand.
So, mm-hmm, in the event that there is an exodus from the cities, yeah, due to whatever, yeah, and people find themselves in the countryside, mm-hmm, trying to scrape out an existence on land that they don't own, and the managerial elite or the land barons call in the sheriff to clear them off the land, mm-hmm, then there's going to be a great deal of hardship, obviously. And these people in this state of conflict are going to have to die, or they're going to have to be taken into the managerial elite's system, which at that point in time is going to be very weakened for a variety of reasons. But I guess what I'm trying to get at is that, yeah, there's a great deal of corruption and degradation of character that's part and parcel of this whole thing. But there is a point at which people simply have to eat, they have to have houses to live in, and the people, the managerial elite, who have been enjoying the protection of their property rights without paying what might amount to a use fee for those property rights. In other words, there is no notion of a wealth tax. There is, in fact, taxation of the economic activity of the middle class in the form of income tax, etc. At some point, they're just not going to be able to maintain their property rights, even with the help of the sheriffs, and even with the help of elimination of posse comitatus, the policy that keeps the U.S. government from using the military against the population. And at that point, I'm not sure exactly how it all plays out, but what I was asking for is sort of an explanation of the origin of the comitatus.
Oh, okay.
After which posse comitatus is named.
Yeah. Okay. Well, essentially what you're talking about there is an old Germanic sort of institution. I mean, it's in the Germanic tribes, the Germanic tribes were organized around two principles, the one being kindred and the other being sort of lordship or chieftainships, or the comitatus, as Tacitus called it. That was, a lord or a chief wants to, make war somewhere, get some booty, pillage, rape, and rob sort of thing. He gathers together a group of followers who are bound to him by oath and so on. So you've got, and this is an example of what Kevin MacDonald calls sort of non-kinship-based reciprocity. That sort of non-kinship-based reciprocity really became much more important in England, as it turns out, than it was on the continent, because when the Anglo-Saxons went over to England, their kindred relationships sort of broke down. And as a result, lordship became more important. One of the reasons for that is, if you think about it, kindred and the way kindred operates is through the blood feud and so on. And if an individual attacks someone who has no kindred to defend him, or if one's own kindred can't control you, there's going to be a lot of disorder. So lords were really in a good position to assert their authority. That was, again, based upon a relationship of an oath of fealty or homage between the lord and his followers. And that whole comitatus institution then is really an example the seedbed for the sort of legalistic dimension of Anglo-Saxon civilization, people bound together by voluntary rather than blood ties that transcend kinship and so on. That's what a comitatus was. And as I say, it's one of the reasons why Anglo-Saxons became sort of selected out for trust. If you could be trusted, then you were more likely to be successful in life, because people would take your oaths seriously. If you couldn't be trusted, you were an outlaw,
In a sense, yeah. This was the origin of the proposition nation.
Yes, in strange. I mean, it takes a long time to work itself out to that denouement, if you like. But yes, I mean, there is a way in which the idea of the proposition nation is right there at the beginning.
So the proposition nation isn't really something that we're trying to get rid of in the most general sense, because of the fact that it's really an essential aspect of Anglo-Saxon social networking. And so the question is, how does one take this idea of the proposition to which one pledges an oath and incorporate it in such a way that we don't end up with the deracinated situation where the elites essentially betray their people?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I guess that's the $64,000 question. I mean, and the problem is, of course, that in a multiracial society, all of those institutions and those expectations that Anglo-Saxons have about their dealings with other people and so on just become extraordinarily maladaptive. They worked while we were living in an Anglo-Saxon world, but in a multiracial world, we're just well, we're just suckers. Is the really what it boils down to. We can be taken for a ride extremely easily.
So somehow there was this was adaptive among Anglo-Saxons
Sure, I mean, like,
because of their kinship at another level. In other words,
yeah.
instead of the blood feud level
Yeah.
of kinship, you have a wider range of
Yep.
kinship within which the proposition nation worked. But if you try to take it outside of that level of kinship, I mean, it's this ironic thing where
Yeah.
you, on the one hand, you're saying, well, it's this oath is a non-kinship based system, but it's a non-kinship based system that is based on
Yeah.
kinship.
In that
See the
racial
problem?
sense of be, you know, in race being a large extended family, yes. I mean, and the strength was, I mean, like, unlike, let's say, Iraq, where virtually everybody marries their cousin because they don't trust anybody who's not part of their, you know, little narrow extended family. You know, if you are prepared to trust strangers, you know, who live in the next town to perform a contractual obligation and so on, and it turns out that they actually do deliver the goods, then, you know, it makes possible a whole lot of things, economically, culturally, and so on, that would not otherwise be possible. And that's really why England led the world sort of commercially and industrially so early and for so long.
It's the proposition of the managerial elites that you can replicate this evolution of trust and non-kinship-based reciprocity outside of the Anglo-Saxon or Germanic realm. What is your answer to that proposition?
Well, that you're not everyone is an Anglo-Saxon. Not everyone comes from a high trust society. In fact, China is notoriously a low trust society. That's why overseas Chinese business networks in Southeast Asia and this part of the world always you know, turn on sort of kinship ties and so on. And that's how they work. Or Jewish groups. I mean, it's much the same. And if you have a group that has a strong sense of ethnic solidarity or kinship solidarity, that's prepared to work to for each other when dealing with individual Anglo-Saxons who think that everybody else is acting as a self-interested individual, then they're mugs. You know, they're such easy prey. You know, I mean, that's the situation. I mean, if you're an individual and a somebody who thinks of himself as an individual, a self-sufficient or autonomous individual, dealing is always vulnerable to competition from an organized group.
So the managerial elite's essential error in their proposition is that the process that created the Anglo-Saxon sense of public trust is not replicable with groups outside of that of the Anglo-Saxon group, due to the fact that there is a different history of selective pressure, or cultural pressure that makes it difficult to assimilate. The basic idea of the other proposition is that, you know, these other peoples can be assimilated simply by the power of this proposition. And what you're saying is that no, this is not as likely to occur as is the assimilation of the Anglo-Saxon tradition into the more kinship-based cultures that are being invited
And
in
that,
by
and
the
that's
managerial
again, I
elite.
mean, that's more or less what McDonald argues, isn't it? That really faced with this situation, let's say faced with when he's talking about the sort of Jewish group strategies, he basically says that we're going to be forced sooner or later to adopt elements of that strategy simply as a matter of self-defense. And there's a kind of a tragedy there, it seems to me, because like that Republican tradition of public-spirited individuals rising out of the public, out of the private realm to deal with matters that pertain to the res publica, it is going to be lost. It is being lost already because politics is no longer about public-spirited individuals moving. It's about, essentially ethnic log rolling and ethnic spoil systems and so on. So anybody who continues to think of themselves as most Anglo-Saxons do, as just an individual public-spirited citizen, is going to get rolled time and time again by organized racial, ethnic, and religious groups that maintain group solidarity and political discipline.
So, how is it that we can go about retaining the characteristics that we so value while competing against these groups that have a more ingrained sense of group
Well,
identity?
once again, I guess paradoxically, I would say, I mean, that we really do just have to press for the Republican reformation of the institutions of our society, ranging from, of the electoral system through the legal profession, through the corporate sector, through and especially the, perhaps even most fundamentally, churches and so on. We really do need to recover what the Anglo-Saxons really had. Underlying that comitatus, ethos and so on, was a profoundly religious sense of being embedded in a world, where the visible world was sort of interpenetrated by, this supernatural kind of world where the dead and the unborn were always in some mysterious fashion present to us in the here and now. They kind of understood themselves as a group that was sort of had, what could you say? Like there was something almost sacred about their very being. We've lost all that, and we have to recover it.
So what was it about the comitatus that embodied this sacred
Well, just the oath.
dimension?
Like there was a kind of a way in which it had a kind of a supernatural sanction. It wasn't,
So the oath,
and
the actually the proposition, or the law of the comitatus, whatever the oath was for the comitatus, was in a sense the dogma of a micro religion. Is that what you're
Well, it's
saying,
sort of
or?
primordial religion. The religion, I mean, religion in its purest and strongest sense, you know, that and in effect, we now in Western Christianity in particular has become a kind of a non-religion. You know, it's all about the here and now. I mean, it's impossible. I mean, people like those early Anglo-Saxons believed that there were, in a certain sense, there were forces in and around them all the time, acting, influencing them in ways they couldn't really understand, but that they had to take seriously. And that's an essential, you know, that's a kind of a religious impulse. I mean, it's because that's what religion is. You know, if you go back to the Latin word religare, it's a way, it's about binding people together.
So what was the role of the leader in the Comitatus with respect to the sacred dimension?
Well, that's why he was a leader, because he, you know, he had charisma. There was something about him, you know, that you know, in German he was Heilerfüll, filled with holiness. It was just obvious that he was in touch with the gods, and the gods were in touch with him. He could make things happen. And conversely, if it turned out he couldn't seem to make things happen anymore, he might wind up hanging from an oak tree. Yeah.
Well, that's interesting. Yeah. This would be the sacrifice of the sacred king.
Exactly.
In a primordial sense. Can you talk a bit about the conception of the sacred king and how that changed with the introduction of Christianity?
Well, it's not so much the introduction of Christianity. I mean, like, actually, when the Anglo-Saxon pagans were first converted, it was more a matter of Christianity being Germanized than the Germans being Christianized, and if you get my drift. I mean, there was a way in which Christianity had to accommodate itself to that kind of pagan tribal primordial religion and so on. What the real change comes with the papal revolution in the 11th century, you know, the 11th, 12th, 13th century, when the church really starts to assert a monopoly over the spiritual dimension of life, and in effect wants to strip the kings of, you know, their franchise over this. So kings are no longer sacral kings. They're no longer seen as being in touch with the beyond, and the beyond is no longer obviously working through them, and so on. And once that starts to happen, then you're a further step along the road towards, you know, what we now call constitutional patriotism. Because, like, the situation we're in now is that, okay, the church took over the spiritual realm, but basically, then the history of the last seven centuries has been one challenge after another to the church's monopoly over that spiritual mediation. And we're now in the position where most people in our societies are practically speaking atheists, whether they know it or not. Even most of the people who go to churches, I mean, they're more concerned about social justice than they are with salvation in the traditional sense. And in any case, salvation, you know, in the Protestant Reformation becomes a way, you know, about working in this world to demonstrate that you've got grace and so on. So it's so you just get the steady, what could you say, move away from religion towards a pure kind of secularism that we're more or less embedded in today.
So the irony of the situation and the introduction of Christianity was that it seemed to be these sacred kings who were approached most directly and most influential in the introduction of Christianity. Yeah. And yet it was Christianity that eventually took from them their sacral role.
Yeah. They still, like you still have king, I mean the Stuarts in England, divine right and all of that. But the whole nature, I mean, kings still claim to be sacred, but for a different reason now. Because they claim to be sacred because they kind of embody the, what could you say, the interests of this whole community. Even James the First, when he was talking about divine, he's claiming he's got this role because God gave him the job of sort of ruling the English people, and that's his role. That's a very di it's because he's supposed to take charge of the terrestrial sphere that he's sacred. That's his, office, if you like. That's a very different thing than the sacral kingship of King Alfred or whatever in the, back in the Anglo-Saxon era. If
So King Alfred, for example, what would have been a truer sense of the sacred king in the sense that, I mean, he might actually end up being hung from a
Yes,
tree,
exactly. That's right. And many of them were, yeah.
and me, I mean, they were, and so one of the things actually that I just recalling my own Christian upbringing, one of the things that was very important about the sacrifice of Christ was that this is a sacrifice to end all sacrifices. The King of Kings. So could it have been that an aspect of the sales job into the Germanic peoples was this disconnect of the role of the sacred king from his potential accountability and sacrifice? If you see what I'm saying. In other words, now all of a sudden he's no longer subject to, I don't know what the dynamics were of actually sacrificing him, if he'd have to be, sacrifice himself voluntarily or if he'd be challenged in single combat or what it was. But in any event, the idea that he would ha actually, if he failed to fulfill his mana or his role in bringing luck to the people would be sacrificed. If he could, get out of that, that would be a pretty good deal from his standpoint, in a very venal
Oh, well,
way.
as it turned out, it was, like because in fact, I mean the kings, the emergent states and so on, went from strength to strength, while the church, gradually has become weaker and weaker over the real strength was with the power that could organize the terrestrial sphere, take charge of secular life and make things happen there that generated, a kind of political capital for the kings and later democratic rulers. And that's the situation we're in now. I mean, that's what I was trying to get at before. I mean, the legitimacy of the modern corporate state has nothing to do with your connection to, the gods or anything like that. It's just a question, ultimately, of can you deliver the goods? And the modern corporate welfare state for the past whatever, since WW2, has been delivering the goods in the most spectacular fashion.
Okay, so in under what circumstances would a king, a sacral king, be sacrificed?
Well, when if you kind of keep losing, you kind of, wars, I mean you can't, the harvest fail, you just if you're just you just don't seem to have that charisma. I mean, you lose your, basically, in a nutshell, he loses his charisma.
Okay.
How do people lose charisma? Well, that's a kind of a mysterious thing, I guess. You know what I mean? Like it's you, in the present losing charisma, however, is not just a matter of not delivering the goods. I mean, losing charisma is being leaving the field of battle, being a coward, being
okay.
dishonorable, being, you know, for whatever kinds of reasons, you know? I mean, just because there's the...
So in some sense, he loses his moral authority, he loses his charisma.
Yeah.
People are no longer inspired.
Yes,
and
exactly.
At that point, there's some process by which he is deposed and ceases to occupy that position with the people, and presumably there's a process by which those people will then find a new sacral king.
Yes, or indeed.
Could you talk about that process? I just wanted you to talk about that process a bit. How that happens? What actually is recorded or is known about what happens during that transition?
Well, I mean, I guess it doesn't even have to happen like that. You know, he loses his charisma, and then they find a new guy. A new guy might just figure that he's got he's got more holiness, you know, more charisma than the guy who's there now. And so he basically just makes war on him. And, you know, I mean, and if the incumbent loses, almost by definition, the gods have deserted him.
So if you have a comitatus, within which the leader has lost his charisma, what happens to the oaths?
Well, then, you know, I guess you kind of start from square one again, you know. But again, like, you got one of the things that's so hard for us to understand about these folks is that, and you can kind of get a handle in a way on what kind of world they live in through things like, you know, Homer, the Iliad, and the Odyssey, and so on. Because if you read the Iliad and the Odyssey, and you look at the way in which Homer sort of describes what's happening, it's clear that the actors in those stories don't really see themselves as the source of their own actions. You know what I mean? Like when someone feels lust or fear or hate or anger, it's almost as if, you know, one of the gods has sort of entered into him and sort of kind of taken over him. You know, like a good spirit, a bad spirit. You know, and that's people didn't. I mean, that's what's so like for us. The spiritual and the temporal are just two utterly incommensurable realms. For these folks, you can't make a separation. You don't understand how they're interpenetrated, but they're interpenetrated. So when you're making an oath, like, it's not you. You know, like this seat of free will and individual volition here that can be held legally culpable, in a sense, for failure to, you know what I mean? Like, it's just, they're not quite at that stage yet. On the way, but not there yet.
Okay, so the oath, when one is pledging the oath, one isn't really signing a contract. One is doing something that's...
You feel bound to
deeper
do.
Deeper or more...
You feel bound to do. You know, the bindingness of it all isn't just your kind of individual free will at this stage. I mean, because... you know, that, you know, in legal terms, that kind of, that's why, you know, if I go and kill your brother, that crime is not necessarily, best dealt with by killing me. You could kill my brother, even though he was innocent. You know what I mean? It's not about mens rea. In that legal sense that we think of now, that kind of stuff only comes, you know, as I say, after the papal revolution, where, you know, because it's for us that we think of oaths and, you know, responsibility and guilt and innocence in very rationalistic terms that presuppose, once again, you know, that separation of the spiritual and the temporal and so on. But
this brings up an idea that I've kicked around for quite a while that I'd like to run past mm-hmm. you. And that is there's this mystery of life that we all face. And certainly our ancestors faced it and had a great deal to do with nature and how one gets along with nature and relates to nature. And one of the aspects of, in particular the British people, is that they've been great naturalists throughout history. Mm. And seems that during the rise of the scientific method and things of that nature, there was a great deal of emphasis on how you go about understanding nature and coming to a better relationship with nature in the pure science sense. Yep. Now, one of the aspects of science is that you run experiments, and this is one of the things that separates it from the theocracy. Mm-hmm. When I'm saying theocracy, I guess I'm talking about this papal revolution sense. In some sense, the Protestant Reformation was a reaction against it, and to some extent, the Enlightenment itself was a reaction, perhaps not an entirely healthy one, but nevertheless, there's this mystery that we face in life. That has to do with how we are going to not only manipulate matter and energy, but how we are going to live our mm-hmm. lives, the rules by which we're going to live them, and the circumstances in which we live them. And in that sense, having people engage in living experiments where there is a proposition that they are bound to test with others of like mind, seems like it might be compatible with the Anglo-Saxon instinct or predisposition to take and follow oaths in a way that's sacral.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, if, for example, you and I might agree or we might differ on something about how we want to live our lives, the rules by which we should live, or the values we should even hold, we can come together in some kind of corporate structure that's this more humanized corporate structure, or we can choose to part and take part of different comitatuses, or comitata, I guess, would be the proper Latin. And in so doing, we are actually bound to uphold the proposition being tested by our own comitatus. Mm-hmm. Or our own community, if you will. So the question becomes, how do you go about constructing a society which recognizes sort of the meta proposition that it is good for people to be able to come together and take oaths, whatever they may be, and then follow them through, perhaps to their very deaths, because they're bound to them.
Mm-hmm.
And provide whatever the superstructure is, the minimum superstructure required to allow them to engage in those experiments so that people can find their chosen way of life and be able to discover their proper relationship with nature. You see what I'm saying?
In large sense. No, that's a very good question. And of course, one of the problems is in trying to organize our lives in that fashion is the managerial state, you know, because the whole premise of the managerial state is that, just think about the way the concept of rights has changed. Back in the Anglo-Saxon tradition, when you're talking about rights and liberties, they were rights and liberties, you know, significantly against the king. The king couldn't do this to us or whatever. Nowadays, rights, so let me finish that thought, and therefore the premise that's built into that is that we can organize our own lives in whatever way suits us, as long as there's no law saying we can't. Now, the whole legal order is based upon exactly the opposite premise, that rights are a way in which the state protects us from each other. And so the basic premise of the managerial state is that we really can't be trusted to organize our lives in autonomous, self-governing communities, because if we were given that freedom, we'd do racist, homophobic, sexist, violent things. And so we really have to be monitored and controlled. And so, once again, I mean, the problem is, how do we get the managerial state off our back and recover our ancestral liberties, in effect? Yeah.
Well, what if we choose to redefine religion to be the comitatus? In other words, the proposition is the religion. The oath is the religion.
Yeah.
And in doing that, what happens is we no longer have to abide by some law that we all agree to abide by through voting, or, you know, we no longer vote with the ballot box in this large overarching sense, but we rather vote with our feet in the more in the comitatus sense. We follow the oath,
yeah,
and the leader that appeals to us at a sacral level. Yeah.
Well, of course, the you know, it's like that Lone Ranger Tonto joke. I mean, what do you mean by we here? You know, I mean, that is the key problem. How do you give a spiritual dimension, you know, in terms of your argument, like a self-created, self-constituted spiritual dimension to just a voluntary agreement between those of us in the here and now? What does that have to do? How do we make that we include the dead, the unborn? I mean, that is really like the essence of a religious problem. And boy, I mean, the theology or the that would have to underlie that is certainly beyond my grasp. I just don't quite know how to think my way towards that, but I think somehow that's what has to happen before we really can do what you're suggesting.
Well, clearly, we're being offered a secular religion that has the police powers of the state enforcing upon us values and norms that many of us find not only objectionable but vitally threatening.
Mm-hmm.
And it's going to come down to something that may, in fact, be on the order of the Protestant Catholic Wars, if not beyond that.
Right.
And that went on for quite a long time, and it was very destructive, and we're still feeling the impacts of that.
Yes, and that's
so.
Yeah.
It's.
I mean, I was just thinking. I mean, when you think about, you know, those kinds of really bloody sorts of conflicts, that's often where that kind of spirit re-emerges.
So would you say that there was a re-emergence of some of the Anglo-Saxon spirituality as part of the Protestant Reformation?
Well, no. I mean, like, again, I mean, it seems to me the Protestant Reformation is just another step along the path that the papal revolution blazed out, you know, because essentially it's about the Protestant, you know, the Puritans and so on. Their whole thing was that, you know, again, the spirit's over here and the temporal world is here, and there is this kind of mysterious connection to them, as we recognize in the incarnation of Jesus Christ and all of that, but. They really just started going down a path that, you know, salvation through works and so on, that really in the end leads to the end of religion. You know what I mean? Like, once you start down the path of salvation by, in effect, achieving success in the exploitation of the natural world, well, that's where we're at now, you know. And so the world has become, in the end, as a consequence of the Protestant Reformation, in, you know, among the Anglo-Saxon people, despiritualized. It is purely material, and that's why the only thing we have to cling to is faith in the divine economy. That's
so. At some point, we need to reincorporate the natural world into our beliefs and our faiths, or our religions, or our sacral communities, so that there's a more sustainable connection with the future, but also with our ancestral past that shaped us. How do you see that occurring? What kind of limits do you see occurring on?
I don't know. Maybe it's one of the things that, again, look, I mean, you've got me sort of way out of my depth here into this theological territory, but there is a kind of a connection, let's say, between that Anglo-Saxon Germanized Christianity and Orthodox Christianity today. You know, there's a kind of a way in which they, in you know, either case, you know, that the kind of split between the spiritual and the temporal worlds isn't as sharp, and in which clearly the idea that the spirit resides in a particular folk seems to be just kind of axiomatic, you know, like the Greek Orthodox, the Serbian, the Russians. I mean, you know, they obviously still have that sense that, it's that old, Israelitic form of belief in themselves as a kind of a chosen people. And certainly that's what Anglo-Saxon Christianity was all about. What they were interested in was not so much the New Testament. What they liked to hear about were all of those stories about the kings of Israel smiting their enemies hip and thigh. And suffering if they fell away from the will of God, sort of thing. So, you know, there's a way in which somehow we've got to recover elements of that and get away from this utopian universalism that now passes itself off as religion in the Western world.
Well, Professor, I think that we've gone about as long as we should go for this, and I'm going to edit this down a bit. But I do appreciate you taking the time to talk to us about your ideas and answer some of the questions, even though we went kind of far afield sometimes.
Yeah, that's right. You need to keep me on a tight leash. So.
Well, you know, and me too. Okay, well, we'll talk to you around.
Yeah.
And hopefully people will get out there and buy your book when you publish it. Do you have an idea when that will
happen? I'm hoping to finish it within a year, and when and how to publish it, that's another question.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay, well, once again, thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you.